This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ضَرَّاءَ مَسَّتْهُ لن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favour after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories this hour. Moscow warns of nuclear escalation, saying the United States and its allies are on the brink of an open military confrontation with Russia over Ukraine. Sri Lanka's president flees to the Maldives before officially handing in his resignation amid violent protests against his economic situation. Rights groups slam the EU's discriminatory asylum policy, citing the appalling conditions of non-Ukrainian refugees in Belgium. Thank you for joining us. Moscow says the United States and its allies are getting dangerously closer to a military conflict with Russia in Ukraine. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova has accused Washington of provoking an escalation of the crisis by launching a hybrid confrontation with Russia. She's warning that such actions could lead to a direct armed conflict between the nuclear powers. Since the beginning of Russia's military operation in February, the U.S. and its Western allies have been offering military support to Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly warned Washington over such military assistance, including delivery of heavy weaponry, saying that will add fuel to the fire of the war. Iran has reacted to a U.S. claim that is planning to supply hundreds of drones to Russia. The foreign ministry spokesman says there is no recent development in technological cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Nasser Kanani said Iran's cooperation with Russia in the field of some new technologies predates the war in Ukraine. He added that his country's stance on the war in Ukraine is quite clear and has been officially announced before. The spokesman noted that Washington's claim comes as the U.S. and Europe have for years turned aggressive countries, including in the West Asia region, into a storehouse of their lethal weapons. On Monday, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan claimed that Tehran is preparing to send several hundred drones to Russia for use in Ukraine. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has concluded an official visit to Italy. It's been 48 hours of intense activity, which included talks with top Italian and Vatican diplomats, as well as meetings with entrepreneurs, geopolitical analysts, and Iranian expats. Max Civili reports from Rome.
On Tuesday, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian wrapped up a two-day visit to Italy, which is expected to boost Tehran's relations with Rome and the Catholic Church. Amir Abdollahian's visit kicked off on Monday at Italy's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Iran's top diplomat held talks with his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio in pursuit of political, economic and commercial cooperation. The two discussed a number of issues, including the situation in Afghanistan, Yemen and Ukraine, and the resumption of talks on the revival of the 2015 deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. At the end of the meeting, Iran's top diplomat stated that there is a promised bright future for the cooperation between Tehran and Rome in the field of energy.
At a political level, it remains to be seen if the Italian government's commitment to expand bilateral relations with Iran is more than just a generic pledge. Much will depend on the outcome of the upcoming U.S. President Biden's Middle East trip.
On Tuesday, the Iranian minister, after participating at a meeting with geopolitical analysts and policymakers at the think tank Institute of International Affairs, held talks with Cardinal Secretary of State Pietro Parolin at the Vatican. How interfaith dialogue plays a key role in alleviating violence and extremism was among the issues touched upon during the meeting. In April, Iran's foreign minister held a phone talk with his counterpart from the Vatican. The top Iranian diplomat talked about painful and inhuman disasters unfolding the world today, which he blamed on a lack of morality and ethics in international relations.
The meeting between the Iranian minister and Cardinal Parolin is an important event, a confirmation of long-standing relations and consolidated friendship between Iran and the Holy See, a meeting that is even more important under the current tensions afflicting the world.
Cultural and economic ties between Tehran and Rome have experienced ups and downs over time, yet Italy has ranked at the top in Europe in terms of volume of trade with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
Sri Lanka's embattled president has fled the country hours before he was due to step down amid major protests over his handling of the economic crisis. President Rajapaksa flew to the neighboring Maldives on a board of military aircraft. He is believed to have left the country to dodge detention. The country has been the scene of demonstrations against a paralyzing economic crisis. On Saturday, the president fled his official residence to avoid an encounter with an angry mob who stormed the building. In the meantime, demonstrators are still on the streets around his house. Also, flocks of people are touring the presidential palace without the security forces intervening to stop them. Rajapaksa has promised to resign on Wednesday. Parliament will elect his replacement a week later. Dozens of refugees live in appalling conditions on the streets of Belgium, but none of them are from Ukraine. Rights groups say the EU's asylum policy is discriminatory. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
It's 7 a.m. on Tuesday, the 12th of July, 2022, and outside Belgium's largest asylum application centre, located at Le Petit Château, close to Brussels city centre. Dozens try to sleep, while dozens more queue up as they wait for the centre to open.
I claimed asylum 1 year ago and I still have nowhere to sleep. You can see all the people on the streets. There's no place to eat or to have a shower.
Look at them, you can see the situation. This situation has been from a long time ago. When you climb asylum, so you shouldn't be in the street like this.
We escaped war in Afghanistan. We came here for help, but have to sleep on the streets and in the park. There is no help for us.
These homeless people are mainly from African countries and Afghanistan. None are from Ukraine.
On the face of it, this might look like a Belgium problem, but perhaps we should be pointing the finger at the EU. The 27-country bloc has bent over backwards to provide housing and education for Ukrainian refugees and deliver a whole host of other benefits. Of course, nobody could argue with that. But is this not discrimination?
That's a question we put to the European Commission.
Is there a two-tier unfair asylum system in the EU?
We work closely with the member states that they have under their competence and with our support. They need to follow up and ensure contingency planning and adequate support for all those fleeing war and persecution so that there is no difference in their treatment.
Critics say Western nations tore countries in Africa and the Middle East apart and now turn their backs on displaced citizens. This as there is no end of money to support Ukrainians. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Nominations in the race to replace British Prime Minister Boris Johnson have closed, with 8 Conservative lawmakers securing enough support to make the first ballot. Candidates needed backing from at least 20 fellow legislators to be on the ballot for runoff votes, which will start on Wednesday. Former Health Secretary Sajid Javid, whose resignation last week helped bring Johnson down, was a surprise casualty, failing to make the cut. 2 other candidates, Transport Secretary Grant Shapps and lawmaker Rehman Chisti, also pulled out after struggling to gather support. The candidates are jostling to replace Johnson, who quit as the Conservative leader last week amid a party revolt triggered by months of ethics scandals. He will remain as in office as a caretaker prime minister until his replacement as party chief is chosen. The winner of that contest will automatically become prime minister without the need for a national election. 9 EU states have rejected Israel's designation of 6 Palestinian civil society groups as terrorist organizations. The countries say they will continue to work with the Palestinians. In a joint statement, the foreign ministries of Belgium, Denmark, France, Germany, Ireland, Italy, the Netherlands, Spain, and Sweden said Israel did not provide credible evidence for its claim. The statement said, as long as such evidence is absent, they will continue strong support for the civil society in the occupied Palestinian territories. Earlier in April, UN human rights experts said the Israeli claims undermined their work as several funders had delayed their contributions while the accusations were being investigated. The rights experts had also called on the international community to continue their support for Palestine. It's the 27th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre, which saw thousands of Bosnian Muslims slaughtered in the cold blood of 1995 by Bosnian Serbs during the war following the breakup of Yugoslavia. The genocide against Muslims was so traumatic that victims remain unfound even to this day. Robert Carter reports on the latest burials and the remaining fears of a repeat.
Another year and more bodies of murdered Bosnian Muslims have been returned to their families as part of commemorations held to mark the 27th anniversary of the 1995 Srebrenica massacre. Close to 3 decades after being brutally murdered, the remains of 47 men and 3 teenage boys were laid to rest at Srebrenica's memorial cemetery.
We found the incomplete bodies 5 years ago. We waited to find more, but it didn't happen. So we decided to bury what we have. Also, I have one more brother who was never found, and I have another brother that we buried before.
It was the worst atrocity on European soil since Nazi Germany, as 8,000 Bosnian Muslim civilians were dragged off and killed by Bosnian Serb forces before being dumped into mass graves. The Srebrenica killings were the bloody peak of Bosnia's war, which came after the breakup of Yugoslavia. The conflict has become characterized by ethnic cleansing and genocide. Many Western countries, along with the United Nations, have been condemned for failing to act in the face of overwhelming evidence war crimes were being committed.
What Muslims need to realise is the years of propaganda by politicians made it all possible. The 8,000 plus dead, the concentration camps, the use of rape of Muslim women as a deliberate weapon of war, so then they would breed the next generation of Serbs. All of these horrors happened because politicians wanted to divide so then they could rule. And even now, nearly 30 years later, guilty Serbian war criminals like Milosevic and Karadzic are seen as heroes and their crimes denied.
On Monday, Holland's defence minister publicly apologised for the massacre, admitting the international community failed to offer adequate protection.
But critics claim it's too little, far too late. What's more alarming is that Islamophobia remains a very persistent problem right across Europe. Following the fall of Nazi Germany, anti-Semitism is taken incredibly seriously by European authorities. But can the same be said regarding anti-Muslim hate? Robert Carter, London.
When it comes to the United States' spending priorities, the numbers seem specially misguided in an era of tight budgets to come. And now lawmakers have once again opted to shower the Pentagon with cash rather than address the country's most pressing issues. Those issues, from poverty and hunger to healthcare, have left tens of millions of Americans in precarious conditions.
The devastating impact of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout continue to take a toll on the world and provide ample reason to reconsider where taxpayers' money is being spent. Several countries have even come to the conclusion that their budget is better off being spent where it can potentially ameliorate the economic pressure on their citizens. In the U.S., however, while such reassessments are long overdue along with the trillions of dollars Congress and successive administrations have lavished on the Pentagon, lawmakers have decided to once again shower the Pentagon with cash, even more than what it asked for. Interestingly enough, this comes while the massive U.S. arsenal and fighting force deployed worldwide have proven to be powerless against grave, non-military threats to national security. Gas prices in the U.S. are at an all-time high. Rent prices have set records for the last 13 months straight. Inflation is increasing so sharply that even the cost of basic utilities has risen by nearly 30% in the last 12 months. There are growing fears that the economy is poised to fall into recession. And now, at a time when Americans are fighting to keep roofs over their heads and feed their families, Congress's plan is to authorize a record-setting $838.8 billion in spending to the Pentagon, nearly $40 billion more than what the military asked for.
American taxpayers should be angry. They are angry. Many are not only angry, they are incensed, and they are protesting. But unfortunately, too many elected representatives in this country aren't listening to their constituents. They're listening to the representatives and the lobbyists of the military-industrial complex, such as Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and General Electric. So when you have those companies and so many others that are pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into the political campaigns of members of Congress and members of the Senate and the president, when they are pouring millions of dollars into their political campaigns, when they spend just an inordinate amount of time on Capitol Hill lobbying for their interests, then you're going to wind up with policies and programs that are sending money to the Pentagon instead of sending money into states for schools and retirement programs and the other types of social welfare programs and that are needed in this country.
Well, that's a wrap on the world news.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The brazenness of Israeli actions is pretty striking. They do what they want, knowing the United States will support them, says Noam Chomsky, linguist and intellectual, in an interview with Mint Press News. This article is written by Ramzi Barut, journalist, published under the heading Chomsky on Israeli Regime Apartheid and BDS. Stay tuned for the details, please. Even before the crisis in Eastern Europe, the world was clearly experiencing an interregnum of sorts. The Iraqi war, the Afghanistan war, the global recession, the refugee crisis, the new scramble for Africa, the U.S. attempt at weakening China, the U.S. own political inability and instability, the war on democracy, and the decline of the American empire. Recent events, however, have finally given these earth-shattering changes greater clarity. With Russia making its move against NATO expansion, and with China and other rising economies, including BRICS nations, refusing to toe the American line. To reflect on all these changes and more, Min Press News has spoken with the world's most cited intellectual, Professor Noam Chomsky. Dinner View, however, largely focused on Palestine. Chomsky's views of the language, the tactics, and solutions affiliated with the Palestinian struggle and the Palestinian discourse. Chomsky believes that calling Israeli regime policies towards Palestinians apartheid is actually a gift to Israel, at least if by apartheid one refers to the South African-style apartheid. I have held for a long time that the occupied territories are much worse than South Africa. South Africa needed its black population. It relied on them, Chomsky said, adding, "The black population was 85% of the population. It was the workforce. The country couldn't function without that population, and as a result, they tried to make their situation more or less tolerable to the international community. They were hoping for international recognition, which they didn't get." So, if the Bantustans were, in Chomsky's opinion, more or less livable, the same is not true for the Palestinians in the occupied territories. The Zionist regime just wants to get rid of the people, doesn't want them. And its policies for the last 50 years, with not much variation, have been just somehow making life unlivable. So you will go to somewhere else. Chomsky said these repressive policies apply in the entirety of the Palestinian territory. In Gaza, they just destroy them. There is over 2 million people now living in high-risk conditions, barely survivable. International law organizations say that they're not likely to even be able to survive in a couple of years. In the occupied territories in the West Bank, atrocities take place every day. Chomsky also thinks that the Zionist regime, unlike South Africa, is not seeking the international community's approval. The brazenness of Israeli regime actions is pretty striking. They do what they want, knowing the United States will support them. Well, this is much worse than what happened in South Africa. It's not an effort to somehow accommodate the Palestinian population as a suppressed workforce. It's just to get rid of them. The events of May 2021 and the popular unity among Palestinians are a very positive change in Chomsky's opinion. So I think this is a positive step. It is wise and promising for Palestinians to recognize we're all in it together, and that includes the diaspora communities. Yes, it's a common struggle, Chomsky concluded. The United States is going in the opposite direction, Chomsky continued, as young people are more critical of Israel, more and more supportive of Palestinian rights. Regarding the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, BDS, Chomsky acknowledged the significant role played by the global grassroots movement, though he noted that BDS has a mixed record. The movement should become more flexible and more thoughtful about the effects of actions, Chomsky noted. The groundwork is there, Chomsky concluded. It is necessary to think carefully about how to carry it forward. We'll be right back.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Deported.
Part one.
We've been here to the United States a lot. We used to come every year for a vacation, and we really liked the U.S. We saw it's a great country.
This is a huge country, this is a beautiful country. This country is country for everybody.
That's why we decided we wanted to continue our life and move here to the U.S. and have a future here in the U.S.
The Megaheads are the perfect picture of an American immigrant family. Samir Megahed, an engineer, moved from Egypt with his wife and four children to a quiet cul-de-sac in Tampa, Florida in 1998. Samir found work and his eldest sons followed in his footsteps pursuing engineering degrees. In 2009, the family celebrated becoming American citizens. But their son Yusuf was missing.
A friend told us, how is Yusuf? We told him, he's fine. He went to a beach trip with some of his friends. He told us, did you see CNN? And we were amazed that he was telling us to check Yusuf on CNN.
In August 2007, Yusuf Megahed was on a road trip with his college friend Mohammed, visiting beaches in the south. They were pulled over for driving 60 in a 45-mile-an-hour zone in the small South Carolina town of Goose Creek. But when Mohammed told the officers he had homemade fireworks in the car, they were both arrested and charged with transporting explosives across state lines.
We saw this as a mistake that will hopefully will be solved by the next day. But then the story didn't end the next day, and it continued now for almost 2 years. He was arrested with fireworks. If any white kid or anyone who's not a Middle Eastern would be stopped by a police officer and he would have fireworks, they would consider this to be something ordinary, and they are going to the beach and they are having some fun. But for a Middle Eastern, even these legal stuff that is enjoyed or allowed for any person living here in the U.S., it's considered to be banned or illegal for him. So I think it was almost like a wake-up call that like Arabs and Middle Easterns and people from an Islamic background, they don't enjoy the same rights or same freedoms offered to other people here in the U.S.
Although no formal charges of terrorism were ever filed, Yusuf was held for 10 months in solitary confinement. It was over a year and a half before his trial began.
In the past 2 years, our life is changed completely. It looks like a nightmare. You live under pressure from the biggest government all over the world. If the biggest government all over the world targeting your son and you know your son is innocent. You're thinking it's crazy. Because Yusuf has a Middle East face and he's carrying Quran, his suspicion on him.
Justify their hatred.
Stop all Muslim immigration. Is that the best way to protect America and our economy from new terror attacks?
The fact of the matter is, these guys want to kill us. We have to fight them. And we have to support law enforcement who want to fight
them.
You know, Quentin goes all over the map here. We got to get these guys before they kill
innocent
people.
And that's got
to
be the last word.
If you are an 18 to 28-year-old Muslim man, then you should be strip searched.
So there's always confusion about Islam. Is it a religion of violence or peace?
Islam is a violent, I was going to say religion, but it's not a religion. It's a political system. It's a violent political system bent on the overthrow of the governments of the world and world domination.
In the years since the September 11th attacks, advocacy groups claim that the United States has witnessed an anti-Muslim and anti-Arab backlash. Issam Zayem is president of the Cleveland office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE. Nationally, CARE has tracked a five-fold surge in civil rights complaints by Muslim Americans since 2001.
The atmosphere and the environment and the media had created a very false perception about Islam and Muslims, especially American Muslims. So we were all lumped in the categories of the fifth column or the terrorists. If you look into the major cities in the country, you will find that there has been major cases all over the country.
The Department of Justice is waging a deliberate campaign of arrest and detention to protect American lives. We're removing suspected terrorists who violate the law from our streets to prevent further terrorist attack. We believe we have Al-Qaeda membership in custody, and we will use every constitutional tool to keep suspected terrorists locked up.
The U.S. Department of Justice refuses to release a tally of how many people it has detained since the beginning of its so-called war on terror. From 2001 to 2003 alone, however, at least 27,000 Arabs and Muslims inside the United States were detained and interrogated by the FBI, and 7,000 arrested. 145,000 Arab and Muslim immigrants were questioned as part of a special registration program. And of those, nearly 14,000 had deportation proceedings started against them. Sami Hamoudi was a PhD student in applied anthropology and an instructor at the University of South Florida, the same university Yusuf Megahed attended as an engineering student. He and his family had moved to Tampa from Palestine in 1992, so Sami could pursue his studies. In 2003, he was arrested as a co-conspirator in the Sami Al-Aryan case and charged with terrorism.
Today, the United States Department of Justice is announcing the indictment of Sami Al-Aryan and seven co-conspirators. All of the defendants, if convicted, face the potential of life sentences. Al-Aryan's U.S. associates and Palestinian Islamic Jihad members arrested today include Sami Hamouda.
At the very beginning of the case, I thought that there are misunderstandings.
They came around 4 a.m., 4 in the morning. They just came knocking on the door very strongly, and my wife woke up and we opened the door. Then they came to me and said, "You are under arrest for charges of terrorism, for supporting terrorism."
Rabia Haddad came to the U.S. to study in 1980, fleeing the violent civil war in Lebanon. After a career with various aid organizations, in 1992, Haddad founded the Global Relief Foundation, or GRF. It became the second largest Islamic charity in the United States, providing aid to 680,000 people worldwide. In 2001, he was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, with his wife and four young children. He worked as the chairman of GRF and volunteered as an imam at the local mosque. 3 months after 9/11, the government designated his charity a terrorist entity.
They raided our offices December 14th. It was a Friday.
And I remember coming home after the Friday prayer. I felt that I was being followed coming back from the mosque. But I didn't think, you know, I thought, well, if they're raiding our offices in Chicago, it's, I think, normal to put me under surveillance or, you know, whatever. But then maybe an hour after that, they knocked at my door and arrested me. And things went downhill from there.
The theory that gave, let's say, legitimacy to all, in their thought, to all of these actions was Muslims and Arabs are either terrorists or potential terrorists. So we have to do things to control these communities. And this is what they did. And this is what they are still doing. Nothing changed.
Back in Tampa, Yusuf's court-appointed lawyer, Adam Allen, worried that the prevailing political and media climate would make his case nearly impossible to win.
Initially, obviously, when you are appointed to represent somebody from the Middle East originally, who is charged with the transportation of explosive materials, as a defense lawyer, you have some great concerns about the ability to successfully represent this individual. The media reaction was that this was some sort of terrorist-related activity. The United States Attorney's Office, although not saying that, certainly wasn't saying it wasn't. And that sort of swelled around this case.
Gary Meringer served as the foreman of the jury in Yusuf Mugahid's trial. He says the tone for the trial was set on the very first day.
The judge asked, does anybody here consider themselves an expert with explosives? And then, and he followed that with, is anybody here fluent in Arabic? And not knowing at all, when you go into being paneled on a jury, you don't know anything about the case. Just some person sitting there in a business suit, and all of a sudden I'm hearing Arabs and explosives, and it's like, whoa.
I mean, if you ask the man on the street, hey, the defendant's from the Middle East, and the government's alleging he's got explosive materials in his trunk, all of my colleagues said, there's no way you're going to win this at trial.
We listened to almost two full weeks of evidence. 40-plus witnesses were put on by the government. I don't know how many documents. It was, I think, over 100.
As the evidence came in, and it kept pointing away from Yusuf, and it kept showing that, you know, if even though there was no physical evidence tying him to it, once it became clear that these items were completely harmless, I felt we should win at trial, and we could win at trial.
The jury, after 3 days of looking hard and fast at the evidence, said, you know, it's the burden of the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was in possession of these materials and that he knew it. It's not sufficient that you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You're not guilty of a crime in this country. And there was, the feeling was, you know, there really wasn't any evidence of that.
When the verdict was not guilty, it was a wonderful feeling. There were tears from the client and the family, and probably the best hug I've ever received from my client's father. Several of the agents that worked for the FBI came up and congratulated us and told us that they were not dissatisfied with the verdict in the case. And it was good to know. And I think I was even quoted in the paper as saying, you know, the system worked. As a lawyer who tries cases and understands the Constitution and the purpose of jury trials and the whole notion that the jury is the true representation of our government, it's a check on our government, and it's what makes us America, is that it's not the government that decides whether somebody's guilty, it's the community, because we are government of the people. And the people in this case, despite all the government's best efforts, said, you know what, you're wrong. It was about one of the proudest days I've ever had as a lawyer professionally. It was wonderful.
We went in and talked to the judge. He counseled us never to talk to anybody ever again about anything that had happened. And as a result of that, we all took all of our notes and all the charts and everything, and we just gave them to the bailiff to shred and burn, and thinking we would never, ever revisit this.
Well, he was acquitted of federal explosive charges just this past Friday, but today Yusuf Megahed is back in the hands of federal agents, and his family tonight is outraged.
On Friday, after a three-week trial, Yusuf Megahed walked out of a Tampa courthouse a free man.
I'm very happy.
Megahed was acquitted on all counts of federal explosives charges, but his freedom was short-lived. Monday, to the surprise of his father, Megahed was arrested all over again.
They arrest my son. They kidnap my son.
Samir Megahed, Yusuf's father, says they were walking out of this Walmart on Bruce B. Downs when more than a dozen customs enforcement agents surrounded them.
They separated between me and my son, and they surrounded me. I tried to use the telephone. They didn't allow me to use the telephone. And put the Yusuf in a small car. I tried to stop in front of this car to let Yusuf to speak to his lawyer. They didn't allow me to do this thing. They kidnapped my son.
I would have personally walked into wherever he needed to be, but instead they chose to surveil him for days after the trial and to arrest him and his father as they are walking out of a grocery store and to surround them by cars and agents and whisk him away in a vehicle.
Tuesday morning, I got to work, I opened up my browser, pulled up the news, and I saw that Yusuf had been arrested on Monday at a Walmart with his dad by immigration authorities. And this has only happened, and I was thinking about this morning, when I saw the Grand Canyon was another example, but where the air got sucked out of my lungs. I read the story and was like, like that. It just was so improbable. After all the time we had spent to find out that he hadn't done anything.
I spend a lot of my time telling the government they're wrong. That's what federal public defenders do. We tell the government they're wrong, and we argue that they're wrong, and we argue what they're trying to do to our clients is wrong. But we respect the system, and we were a part of the system, and we believe in the system. At that moment in time, not only did I not want to be a part of the system, but I didn't want to be an American. I was no longer proud of our system, and I was certainly not proud of our government.
Many a time, you know, I'd be sitting in my cell all alone, and I would have this slit in the wall that was about maybe 5 inches wide. That was the only window to the outside world. I would only see shadows and, you know, the colors of the sunset, but never really the sun. And I would sit there and wonder if I'm ever going to see a sunset again.
Of course, to this day, not a single charge has been filed against GRF or against any of the employees of GRF, including myself.
I was acquitted from all charges, and in the media, the jurors were saying that we didn't know why they brought him to the case. They took the first decision in half an hour. They voted without any discussion that I was innocent of all charges.
They didn't have enough to bring criminal charges, to charge me as a criminal, as a terrorist. The only accusation they would make against me is that I had overstayed my visa.
I was acquitted. The second day in the morning, ICE came. My attorney asked the judge to release me, but the judge wouldn't accept that.
The lawyer had told them that, like, he should be out in, like, 2 or 3 days just until they process the paperwork and everything. And we kept waiting, and then they transferred him to the immigration facility. And every time we would keep trying, like, for the first, I think, week or two, like, even, like, my dad's lawyer couldn't get any information on what's going on. It wasn't something that was, like, unheard of, and it wasn't something like that I thought couldn't ever happen, because I saw it happen or I've heard of it happening, but it was just, I didn't expect it to happen to my father.
I was denied bond based on the fact that they considered me a danger to the community. When my whole community was actually demonstrating and protesting and what have you. And they were treating me like the most dangerous, worst criminal ever. When I was taken from my cell to my first immigration hearing, the security they had was unbelievable. They had a sheriff's deputy stationed almost every 10 feet all the way from the door of my cell to the building almost next door. My trial was behind closed doors. I was put in solitary confinement on a floor all by myself in a very tight cell. And they had a camera fixed right on me. The cell door had a small window, and the camera was right there. It was clear then that this wasn't about immigration or me overstaying my visa or anything like that. They were going after me with everything they got.
One time I passed through the observation room of the guard, and I saw my picture there. So I asked one of the guards why my picture is there. He said, because you are a threat, and we have to keep an eye over you for 24 hours. And this was from ICE. They gave them this information.
The thing that got to me the most was just not knowing what's going to happen, not knowing whether I'll be able to see him again, whether he'll, just be there for, these major events in our lives.
Very quickly, we presented to ICE that I have a passport. I don't need a visa. I can go tomorrow to my country, and I am willing to do that. They said, no, we have to wait.
He would try appealing, and then there would be different court dates, and, nothing would come out of it, and then different promises. And then at the end, they told us, if you just leave voluntarily, we promise he'll be on the flight with you. We kept expecting to find my father there, and he didn't show up. At the end, the immigration officer, he told me, he's like, I can't respond to your questions anymore.
After almost 3 years in prison, two of those in solitary confinement, Sami Hammoudi was found innocent of all terrorism charges. But instead of being released, he was transferred to an immigration jail. For 6 months, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, refused to either release or deport him, even after he agreed to voluntary deportation to reunite with his family. Hammoudi's lawyers brought ICE to court. 2 days before the trial, Hammoudi was deported in secret.
So on the 23rd, they took me to the airport and deported me. So it wasn't their plan to deport me this way. If we didn't go to the federal judge and ask him to either release me or deport me, they wouldn't do that.
We didn't even know, because we were used to him calling, and then he didn't call for 2 days, so we didn't know what was going on. And my mom called his lawyer, and he didn't have an idea of what's going on, and we kept trying to get in touch with people. And she was kind of freaking out, because it was just, you couldn't get in touch with him. No one knew what was happening to him.
It's the humiliation of being deported and traveling in a t-shirt and sweatpants and prison shoes and having these agents with you. It's especially for somebody who has my good name and my reputation are the only assets I have in this world. I don't have any money in any bank accounts. I don't have any land. I don't have any. This is the only thing I have. And the U.S. government made sure to attack me on these two. They have ruined my reputation. They have ruined my good name. And they have accused me unjustly of things that are complete fabrications. They could not prove anything because there was nothing there. But with the USA Patriot Act, they didn't have to prove anything. It was enough for the government to say, we suspect.
They think that accusing people, destroying their lives, is something they can do. This is what worries me. It is the arrogance of the powerful.
America before, I won't say before September 11th, America before the USA Patriot Act was one thing, and after the USA Patriot Act was a completely different country. I will not be exaggerating if I said America today is a police state, just like any other third world police states.
It is actually the Dark Ages. It is the mentality of the Dark Ages, where governments could do anything they wanted to do.
In criminal court, the burden of proof is with the prosecution. They would have to make their case, they would have to prove. In immigration, all they have to do is just cast doubt upon them.
They do whatever they want to do. And they have the laws, they have everything they want to lie, even lie.
In the limelight.
Scientists say carbon capture is hard and expensive, and focus must be on reducing carbon emissions. We now present you an article written by Helena Horton. The piece is titled Greenhouse Gas Removal Not a Silver Bullet to Achieve Net Zero. Many of Britain's top scientists working on carbon capture technologies do not believe they will be developed and scaled up in time to reach net zero and limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Experts speaking at a greenhouse gas removal hub event in London warned that these techniques, including direct air capture, biofuels, biochar, afforestation, and advanced weathering, are not a silver bullet and should make up just a fraction of the effort to decarbonize. The researchers were polled by event organizers on whether they believed the carbon removal targets would be met. Of the 114 scientists in the audience, 57% said they were not confident that Britain would meet the 2030 goals in the net zero strategy of 5 million tons of engineered greenhouse gas removal and 30,000 hectares a year of tree planting. 25% said they were quite confident, and 11% said there was no chance. The scientists are taking part in a £70 million government-funded competition to find the best ways to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. These technologies are due to begin removing vast amounts of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere by 2030. With the hope of being that the winning methods could be scaled up and ready for market in 2 years' time. The government appears on the whole to be confident that carbon capture methods will be developed fairly rapidly. For example, the Department for Transport has stated that greenhouse gas removal technologies will enable Britons to take guilt-free flights by the end of next year. But those involved in the programme were less optimistic. But when shown a press release from the British government declaring that these technologies will enable net zero flights by 2023, Professor Mark Taylor, the Deputy Director of Energy Innovation at the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, seems sceptical. He told The Guardian, "No, that's not the case. We've got to get people to believe this can work, but maybe that claim is a little bit cheeky." Gideon Henderson, the chief scientist at the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, said, "Greenhouse gas removal technologies is hard and expensive, and we cannot afford to see it as a surrogate to compensate for continued emissions in sectors that can be decarbonized. It is not an excuse not to decarbonize, so we must drive down emissions anyway." By far the most popular technology based on applications to the program was direct air capture. This process involves removing carbon dioxide from the air, usually using giant fans and heating it to a very high temperature. This carbon can then be stored in geological formations or combined with hydrogen to create synthetic fuels. While ministers like this idea, those leading the program believe it may not be the answer due to the energy intensity required and how expensive it is. Professor Taylor said, "People see it as having the biggest market. There's been funding from American companies. It feels like a silver bullet. There are lots of people who like it. Ministers like it because they think, oh, that sounds easy. You can take it out of the air and that's it. And that's the thing that gets investment." Professor Taylor added, "I'm very much on the fence as to whether it is the best solution. It is very, very expensive. So some of the other technologies may emerge as winners. But the good thing about our competition is we pick the best one." The Guardian approached the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy for comment. Greenhouse gas removal methods being trialled with UK funding include afforestation. Henderson said this is the poster child of greenhouse gas removal technologies because